couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week we've got a jam-packed show because not only do we've got a couple movies to review, we also have trailers to talk about, we've got listener feedback, we've got an interview with Scott McTavish and Dan Murphy from the new documentary Murph the Protector, which is somewhat related to the new release Lone Survivor, and we'll talk more about that later. We're also going to have the world-famous DVD Roundup, but before we talk about anything else, I want to remind everybody to watch the Critics' Choice Movie Awards on Thursday, January 16th at 8 p.m. on the CW. Now, the reason that's important is because I'm actually a voting member of the Broadcast Film Critics Association, which puts on those awards, and if you've been listening to me over the last year, especially over the last few months, and hearing what I have to say about award contender films, you can watch this this presentation and find out if my voting has actually impacted the awards and does it agree with what I have to say. The Oscars don't care. The Academy doesn't care what I think, but the BFCA does. And so you can watch those awards Thursday, January 16th, 8 p.m. on the CW. If you want to get in touch with us, you can call us at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. We've got a voicemail this week that we're going to play for you. If you want to email us, you can email us at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com, or you can find us on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com, on Facebook at facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies, and twitter.com/KevinCarr to find me. Let's jump right in.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
We've got some news items to talk about. The first one is the Michael Bay meltdown. Now, this is interesting because, you know, anyone who knows me knows I just hate Michael Bay. I'm not a big fan of his films. I think he's a blowhard. I think he is all about beer commercial filmmaking. And what happened was he went to the Consumer Electronics Show. Not the porno section of the Consumer Electronics Show. That's the other floor. But the regular Consumer Electronics Show, where they're unveiling new technology and that sort of thing. And he was at the Samsung display or at an event where Samsung was showing their new curved 105-inch TV and how super high definition and that sort of thing. And he went on stage and just kind of fell apart. We've got a clip. I want to play it for you so you hear what actually happens.
You know, you're known for such unbelievable action. What inspires you? How do you come up with these unbelievable ideas?
I create visual worlds that are so beyond everyone's normal life experiences. And Hollywood is a place that creates a viewer escape. And what I try to do is as a director, I try to... the type is all off, sorry, but I'll just wing this.
Tell us what you think.
Yeah, we'll wing it right now. I try to take people on an emotional ride. And
the curve? How do you think it's going to impact how viewers experience your movies?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, let's thank Michael Bay for joining us.
The internet is reporting this like he had a meltdown, like he freaked out over everybody. And he really didn't. Here's the thing. I'm not a big fan of Michael Bay. I think he's an idiot. But the guy just isn't good at doing public speaking. And he actually wrote on his blog an explanation of it, which I thought was relatively humble, where he says, "Wow, I just embarrassed myself at CES. I was about to speak for Samsung for their awesome curved 105-inch UHD TV. I rarely lend my name to any products, but this one is just stellar. I got so excited to talk that I skipped over the exec VP's intro line, and then the teleprompter got lost. Then the prompter went up and down, and I walked off. I guess live shows aren't my thing." Here's why I have respect for Michael Bay on this. He didn't wig out. He didn't blame other people. He got out there and said, "Guys, look, I messed up. And I was an idiot for what I did. This is not my wheelhouse. I can make amazing action films, but I can't do public speaking." And you know what? More power to the guy for being humble and being honest about it. So you mark your calendar, set your clocks. This is the time that I actually defend Michael Bay on the open airwaves. Here's a piece of news that's really hilarious in its own right. And it involves our good friend, Nicolas Cage. And if you don't know anything about Nicolas Cage's career, it's really hit the skids. I mean, he was in The Croods, which is a very fun and neat little kids movie that was animated this year. But his regular dramatic career has really fallen apart. He's doing a lot of direct-to-video. He's got a lot of bills to pay, taxes and such. But apparently he's in the remake of the Left Behind series, which is remaking a Kirk Cameron series. And that's usually a step down if you're going from Nicolas Cage doing massive action roles to remaking Kirk Cameron's films. And this is the Left Behind series, which is about the Rapture. And apparently during a Facebook Q&A earlier this week, there were fans worried that the Rapture was going to happen before they had a chance to see this movie, that it was taking that long to produce. And you know what? Nicolas Cage is some amazing things. He also was a vampire. If you actually look at, there's old pictures of him from 200 years ago. Apparently, he can also cause the Rapture. So watch out, tax collector. Another real quick thing to talk about news-wise, they had the People's Choice Awards this week, and Sandra Bullock won 4, which is kind of unprecedented when you think about it. Now, she won for Gravity. She won for Best On-Screen Couple with George Clooney. She won for Best Comedic Actress. She really kind of swept the awards, and that's good for her. I'm not a big fan of the Heat, but you know what? Hey, Sandra Bullock, good for you. 4 awards. This is sort of like the time you won an Oscar for The Blind Side and a Razzie for All About Steve in the same award season spread. Now that music tells us that we're going to be talking about the trailer park. Real quick, 2 trailers I want to point out that have hit this week or recently in the last couple days. The first one is 22 Jump Street, which opens on June 13th. And let's just play it real quick.
Well, I hoped never to see you again.
What's up, dog?
We're back. We in
hell! Ladies, nobody cared about the Jump Street reboot, but you got lucky. We in hell! So now this department has invested a lot of money to make sure Jump Street keeps going. We in hell! The only problem is the Koreans bought the church back, so we're moving you across the road to 22 Jump Street.
I thought the first one was funny. I thought it was entertaining. I think Channing Tatum is a better comedic actor than he is a dramatic actor, and Jonah Hill makes a great foil for him. I'm just hoping that the rest of the trailer, which is mostly sight gags, isn't all the best parts. So we'll see what happens. The next trailer I want to highlight is a thing called Transcendence, opening April 18th. It's directed by Wally Pfister, who is the DP for Christopher Nolan's movies.
A series of attacks conducted by a radical anti-tech group known as Rift.
They hit AI labs all over the country.
We lost decades of research and development.
It's radiation poisoning. The bullet must have been laced with it. The effect is irreversible.
Will's body is dying, but his mind is a pattern of electrical signals. We can upload his consciousness.
If we missed anything, a thought, a childhood memory, how will you know who you're dealing with?
This fascinates me because it's one of my favorite things in science fiction, and that are people doing the right things for the right reasons and having to go disastrously wrong. I love movies about people who try to help humanity and end up wiping it out in the process. So I'm really looking forward to Transcendence, and we'll see if Pfister can do as good of a job as Nolan does in his films. So let's move on to one final thing I want to talk about. This is listener feedback. We got an email from Josh from Michigan, and his point is, given last week's reviews, are there any movies coming out in 2014 where people don't die in them? Well, you know what, there are. I mean, I don't think anyone dies in Her. Hopefully that's not a spoiler, but there's some stuff happening over the next couple months. Usually it's kids movies. I mean, The Nut Job, I'm assuming the movie about squirrels isn't going to have people dying. Probably Ride Along's pretty safe, a stupid comedy. The Lego movie, who knows? There's a lot of movies that I'm sure. Pompeii, everybody dies in that one, so let's not worry about that. Peabody, Mr. Sherman, Muppets Most Wanted, Rio 2, stuff like that are probably safe. There are movies, but see, there's a bunch of movies with death in the title that you're going to want to avoid. Lone Survivor pretty much tells that there's going to be some death in that. 3 Days to Kill, A Million Ways to Die in the West, Transformers, Age of Extinction, Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, and Jane's Got a Gun all pretty much telegraph there's going to be a certain level of violence or killing in them. And you know, if you don't like killing, if you can't figure it out from the title, the ones you're going to want to avoid this year, stuff like RoboCop, 300 Rise of an Empire, The Purge 2, The Expendables, The Green Inferno, which caused a lot of trouble when it was shown at film festivals, The Equalizer, and of course, The Hunger Games, or Mockingjay Part 1. We've got to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking The Legend of Hercules, Her, and Lone Survivor. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. After that whirlwind first segment, which included everything from Michael Bay to Nicolas Cage, and the one who you'd think would wig out was not the one who wigged out. But after that segment, let's slow it down a little bit and do some movie reviews, because there's a couple movies that have been out in limited release, like New York and LA, for a couple weeks, just so they could get into award consideration. I had a chance to see those earlier, but now we finally get a chance to open them up to the rest of America so they can see the films. And the first one I want to talk about is Spike Jonze's Her. In the not-too-distant future, a lonely man falls in love with an artificially intelligent operating system on his smartphone.
Mr. Theodore Twombly, welcome to the world's first artificially intelligent operating system. Please wait as your operating system is initiated.
Hello, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Samantha. Good morning, Theodore.
Good morning.
You have a meeting in 5 minutes. You want to try getting out of bed?
You're too funny.
Okay, good, I'm funny. I want to learn everything about everything.
I love the way you look at the world.
With Spike Jonze, you can always be assured that his movies are going to be thinking outside of the box. He's directed films like Being John Malkovich and Adaptation and Where the Wild Things Are. And even Where the Wild Things Are, where you'd think it would be a relatively straightforward children's book adaptation, it was really out there and it was different. And you get always, even if you don't like his movies, they're unique. He's one of the few directors in Hollywood that will actually deliver a film that is different from everything else you're ever going to see. So when he did Her, this is one he actually wrote as well as directed, and it has that very specific Spike Jonze touch. Now, what's neat about the movie is it's a science fiction film, sure, because it takes place in the future with higher technology, and it has this smartphone and this intelligent, artificially intelligent operating system. But it gives it a very normal feel to it. The technology isn't overbearing. There's a couple scenes where you see some very innovative technology, but overall, it's just a guy living in LA. And Joaquin Phoenix, who really kind of went off the deep end a couple years ago, kind of in this performance art mentality, where he did that movie, I'm Still Here. And it was right after he was in Walk the Line. And he came back and really made a splash again and proved what a great actor he was when he did a film like The Master, which came out last year. Now, the thing with Her is he plays an understated character. This is not an award grab. This is not a movie where you would expect, they're seeking awards, but they're winning awards for it. And the core to the film is, Joaquin Phoenix's character, falling in love with this operating system. And even though that sounds somewhat crass, it's a very realistic portrayal of relationships. In fact, even though one of the people, quote unquote, people in this relationship is artificial, it's probably one of the most real relationship stories I've seen, because it doesn't romanticize it. It romanticizes certain parts of relationships, because we always do, but it also shows the reality without victimizing. It just shows how difficult it is for two sentient beings to get together and find common ground in a relationship setting. And I'm not a huge fan of Scarlett Johansson, but she does a fine job as the voice of Samantha, which is the operating system he falls in love with. But you also have other humans involved going through the same thing. Amy Adams plays, again, in a very Spike Jonze way. She's very downplayed. She looks bleaker than she normally does. She's not gorgeous and pretty as she normally shows up in movies like American Hustle. She just looks like this very mousy redhead. And so you see the humanity of her and our flaws, as humans, and then why we would be attracted to something artificial. This is not new ground. This is not new territory. They did the movie Simone with Al Pacino several years ago. Bomb. Nobody saw it. But the idea of having people fall in love with something artificial is nothing new. I remember reading a science fiction comic from the 50s from the old EC line, like Weird Science, where this guy was programming an operating system and it gave a fake presentation of a woman and he falls in love with a woman. So this is nothing new. We've seen this in Twilight Zone episodes and that sort of thing. But it always is it's a nice way to safely look at human relationships without having it cut too close to the bone. Her is a beautiful movie. Definitely worth checking out. Definitely unique. You're not going to see anything else like it from last year or this year. And I say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Let's move on to another piece of listener feedback. This comes from our good friend Thomas from Seattle. He and I had an interesting Twitter conversation. I was on Twitter. You can find me at Twitter on twitter.com/Kevin Carr, because you're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. And I was watching The Lone Ranger the other day, and I was like, I tweeted out how much I liked that final action scene with the rousing William Tell overture. And, you know, it's better than the rest of the film. And while it was an unfairly maligned movie, there were a lot of problems with The Lone Ranger, and Thomas and I ended up engaging in a conversation. So he has a follow-up to that conversation.
Hey, Kevin, it's Thomas from Seattle. We were just chatting on Twitter a bit about how that last scene in The Lone Ranger was like a really, really, really good scene. And I was wondering if there's any other movies that you can think about that were pretty bad or mediocre, but had like one good scene in them. That you kind of just wish, like, oh man, if the movie had matched that one scene, that movie would have been a classic. And I think The Lone Ranger is one because it's just like it was a mediocre movie, but that last scene was amazing. I've watched it like 5 times this week on DVD. Anyway, Thomas from Seattle, talk to you soon and keep up the good work. Bye.
Yeah, this is the thing. There's not a whole lot of movies where it's just like everything's either mediocre or bad, and then there's one scene that really strikes me. What I usually find happening are there movies that as a whole are not very good or just fiercely mediocre, but there's elements to them that I find fascinating and brilliantly put together. Pretty much anything directed by David S. Goyer. Now, he wrote The Dark Knight and he's a brilliant writer, but when he directs his movies, which he hasn't done very many of, movies like The Unborn and The Invisible, they're terrible. They are awful movies. But they make great trailers because any one scene you can lift and it looks good. And it's sort of that connective tissue that doesn't work for Goyer's work. Another great example of a recent one is RIPD came out this summer with Jeff Bridges and Ryan Reynolds. And there's some great stuff in that film. Some great stuff, some great lines and some great scenes and some great characters. But wow, it's a mismanaged film. It's sort of like a football team. If you have a football team that has the greatest quarterback ever, you can put the greatest quarterback ever and the greatest wide receiver ever on a football team. And if the coach isn't doing his job, it's not going to win the Super Bowl. So, I mean, oddly, I'm making a sports analogy and I'm not a huge sports fan. Other ones that are interesting, like that have lifted scenes that are brilliant. Zack Snyder's Sucker Punch has some great action to it, but man, the movie is bad and doesn't hold together. Sky Captain of the World of Tomorrow is incredible, visionary. It's gorgeous and it's fascinating. And I love the look back at the automatons and the old Superman cartoons, paying a homage to those. But that movie just does not hold together. It tries to be too much to everything. And then I had to throw this in there because we're talking The Lone Ranger as a scene, a movie that has a one scene that's really good. The rest of the movie isn't as strong or it's bloated or it doesn't fit together as well. Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, the third Pirates movie, has an amazing climax with amazing action and amazing scope. But you gotta just wade through a lot of garbage to get there. So, yeah, there's a lot of movies like that. And any one action scene can be brilliant, but if you don't put together the rest of the script and the story, your movie can suffer. We will be back with more Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. We'll be talking Hercules and Lone Survivor. back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. After that more, let's just say, that last segment was a little bit softer. It was more romantic. It was about Joaquin Phoenix falling in love with Scarlett Johansson in a smartphone. This segment is the much more macho side of Fat Guys at the Movies. This is the Fat Men at the Movies segment, because we're going to be talking about some heavier, thicker, meatier, muscle-bound movies. One that's ridiculously silly and one that's a true story of American heroism. You can figure out which ones each one is as we move through the segment. The first movie we're going to be talking about in this segment is The Legend of Hercules. Renny Harlin directs this modern adaptation of the legendary Greek demigod with Twilight's Kellan Lutz as the title character.
The peace between our houses will be sealed when my heir, Prince Iphicles, will take the princess of Crete to be his wife.
Come on! Has come on our shores! I give you...
Now, I've been going around calling this affectionately the Legend of Hercules, because it stars Kellan Lutz. And Kellan Lutz is known for some things. His acting ability is not what he's known for. Let's just face it. This guy is the cinematic example of a typical meathead. The guy is, he's a good looking dude. Don't get me wrong. He is a good looking dude, and he has a body with rippling muscles, almost as perfect and just beautifully formed as mine. Under all my fat, it's there. And if I built the muscles up, it would look exactly like Kellan Lutz. But he's not known for acting. And it is no big surprise, seeing his performance in Hercules, his acting is not exactly what you would consider top of the line, middle of the line even. It's sort of lower end. But here's the thing. Renny Harlin does an amazing job of surrounding Kellan Lutz with terrible actors, and the other people in the movie are even worse than him, because there's a certain desire of actors whenever they do a sword and sandal movie to talk in a British accent, even if it takes place in ancient Greece, because I guess they feel it's more Shakespearean. I guess they feel it's more like something you'd see on the BBC. So everybody's talking in these somewhat hoity-toity attempts at accents that really aren't anything. And then there's one guy in there. He's a Serbian actor who shows up in everything. And of course, he's got his thick moose and squirrel accent through the whole movie. This film is not what I would call a good movie. But I can't say I didn't have a heck of a lot of fun watching it. Why? Partly because I love Renny Harlin. Renny Harlin is the cinematic equivalent of fast food. Movies like The Long Kiss Goodnight, Deep Blue Sea, even Cutthroat Island, one of the most notorious box office bombs in the history of cinema. These are fun movies to watch. Now, he had a bit of a slow, rough period in the 2000s with movies like The Covenant and Driven and that Exorcist prequel, whatever version he did of it. But you know what? The guy can do fun action. And if you like 12 Rounds, that movie with John Cena 4 or 5 years ago, which was basically Die Hard on the road, if you like those kind of movies, you might like Hercules. The problem is with this movie is it does draw too much from the existing zeitgeist of filmmaking for these sword and sandal pictures. Once 300 came out and had all the stuff with virtual sets and lots of CGI and the ramping speeds of the film, of the sequences, everybody does that. And Harlin is no exception. In this movie, it looks like it could be edited almost seamlessly. With 300, just not as solid of an action flick. But there's a certain enjoyability to the awfulness of this film. I enjoyed it in a very ironic way. And it was fun. I can't say I didn't enjoy it. And I guess in January, when you're seeing a movie in the theaters, that's not an award film that's getting a later release. When it's a brand new movie in January, the only thing you can really hope for is to be entertained. And you know, doggone it, I was entertained by this movie. It's not great, and but it's short. It's not, sometimes with these sword and sandal films, there's a temptation for it to go on. And this one doesn't. And that's actually kind of works to its favor. So it's the best Hercules movie of 2014. So far, because we're getting a whole bunch of these. We got 300 Rise of an Empire coming up in a couple months. We've got the Hercules with Dwayne The Rock Johnson coming up this summer. So yeah, ultimately, I have to give this a kind of sucks, but I kind of enjoyed it.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. All right, you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on to the next film, which is Lone Survivor. Peter Berg directs this true story of a team of Navy SEALs whose mission is compromised in the mountains of Afghanistan, and they have to fight for their survival.
Going in with a four-man team? Navy. It's a lot more than 10 guys. It's an army. This op is compromised.
This is Spartan 01, radio check.
Danny, you radio working? The way I see it, we got two options. One, you let them go, roll the dice.
Second that they run down there, we got 200 on our backs.
I'm not a fan of Peter Berg. I've always kind of considered him to be a Michael Bay wannabe. And if you heard the first segment, you know that I'm not a big fan of Michael Bay to begin with. Peter Berg's done some pretty terrible movies, stuff like The Rundown. And, you know, everyone seemed to like Friday Night's Lights. I didn't like Friday Night Lights. Battleship was just dumb. But you know what? The guy can do decent action. And his strongest films tend to have a military focus, because up until now, I considered The Kingdom one of his better films. This one is better than The Kingdom because it doesn't get as preachy. The Kingdom gets very preachy at times. And it over Hollywoodizes the war that's going on in the Middle East. The Lone Survivor, what's nice about this movie is it has a very realistic approach to the unfortunate and regrettable and difficult decisions that have to be made at the moment, boots on the ground, and the consequences that are going to happen, good or bad, to you and the people around you, not just the ones that you have effect on, which would be your engaged enemy, but also how it's going to affect you. And sometimes you have to make bad decisions because it's the right decision to make. And it tugs at your heart, because let's face it, the title of the movie is a spoiler on its own. You know there are bad things that are going to happen. If you follow the news when this happened in the news, you know that this is not going to work out hunky-dory. Everybody's not going to TCBY to get yogurts at the end of the film. You know it's going to have some ugly moments. You know it's going to have some heartbreaking moments. But that's sort of the movie's strength, and the fact that it is based on a true story. And I know there's been some liberties taken with the book, that was Marcus Luttrell's book, Lone Survivor. But Peter Berg, say what you want to about him, he at least is out there to honor the American military and not demonize them, and to portray the soldiers as real people. Well, they're not soldiers, they're SEALs. But to portray the people in combat as real people and not as head cases, which is usually what happened. There was a whole rash for the last 10 years of military movies that just showed soldiers and sailors and airmen as just whacked out head cases that couldn't go home and couldn't walk straight. This movie portrays them as real people in a combat situation doing things that they have to do, which are sometimes very ugly. But they also, he portrays them as human beings. And that's a good thing. So I appreciate what Peter Berg's doing with the movie. I don't necessarily want to see it again, because it does have certain inspiring elements to it, but it's not the easiest film to watch, especially if you know people who are deployed or you know people who are put in harm's way every day in situations like that. So I'm going to give this movie a rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
The one thing we'll talk about here on the next segment, because it sort of relates to Lone Survivor, there's a movie called Murph the Protector, which is a documentary about the life of one of the other SEALs on this mission. And I had a chance to talk to the director, Scott McTavish, and Dan Murphy, who's the father of Michael Murphy, that the Murph the Protector is about. So I have that interview in the next segment. We're going to kick off with that and talk about some people who really were connected to the real events that happened in this film. So that's what we got coming back from the break. Stay tuned for more Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We are moving into the final segment. We still got some cool things going on here. One of the things we have is an interview with the directors, Scott McTavish and Dan Murphy, who worked on Murph Protector, which is a DVD that is available this week about one of the SEAL team members who was killed in the operation that Lone Survivor is based on. But before we get to that, let's talk real quick about box office. The box office last week was somewhat predictable, somewhat not. There was a bit of a dip with Paranormal Activity. The marked ones, it did not make. I said 25 million. It didn't make that much. It actually played a little softer than some people expected because it was different. It wasn't being released in October. It wasn't being released in, it was instead being released in January. So we'll see how that one did. It's sort of an offshoot to the series. Frozen ended up winning the weekend with 20 million. Which is fantastic because I'm all about Frozen. I think it's a great movie. It's a great movie for girls. It's a great movie for boys. So it's nice to see this movie just keeping its place. It's probably at, by this point, it's at over 300 million. And it's one of the highest grossing movies of 2013. Paranormal Activity, the marked ones only did 18 million, means it'll probably top out in the 30s. These things don't tend to have very big legs, especially in January. Then you had Hobbit, Wolf of Wall Street, cranking down, the list. There wasn't a whole lot, going on. The things that are interesting to note, 47 Ronin is pretty much done. With 5.1 million in this last week in the theaters. It's only at 33 million. Cost 175 million to make. So that's a big loss for Universal. And then A Medea Christmas unfortunately cracked 50 million. So that means we're going to get more of that garbage. Anyways, this week, I think I'm going to predict take that 18 million from Paranormal Activity and assign it to Hercules. I think that's what's going to win the weekend. Just because I don't think Her has as big of a reach. And I think, Lone Survivor also has a chance. I mean, Lone Survivor could go, but it just early screenings, it wasn't doing as well as they expected. But who knows? Maybe it'll resonate with the American public. Let's move on real quick now to the interview that I've got with Scott McTavish, who's the director, who's the first person you'll hear in this cut. And then Dan Murphy, who's the father of Michael Murphy, who is the movie's about. And it examines his life, not just as a Navy SEAL, but also as a son and as a member of a community. What has been the response from seeing this film from audiences?
Well, I mean, the metrics speak for themselves. I mean, we've been very blessed with a very positive response. My job was pretty easy. I just had to tell the story. I had to point the camera and talk to the right people. And Michael's story tells itself. And the audience has responded to it. We've gotten positive reviews from Washington Post and Hollywood Reporter, New York Times. You know, our audience approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes is 98%. So I think the audience is really appreciative of what of Michael's story and the sacrifice that he made.
How did the documentary start? I mean, whose idea was it? Was Scott? Was it something that you came to the family with, or was it something initiated by the family?
When we first discussed it, Kevin, we had discussed a feature film, you know, a dramatization, and the more that we talked about it, the more that we thought about it, and the more we realized that trying to do a parallel big-budget Hollywood type of film competing with Lone Survivor probably was not the right way to do it. I finally went back to Dan and said, you know, Mr. Murphy, we should consider possibly doing this as a documentary. And tried to sync it up with the commissioning of the USS Michael Murphy in New York City.
One of the things that I was impressed with the film was that it didn't really seem to have an agenda. I mean, in terms of anything political, it wasn't pushing or anything. It was an honor honoring Michael Murphy and giving his background. Were there any sort of pitfalls you were trying to avoid in making this so that it wouldn't turn into something or spiral out of control or get beyond what your original concept was?
When I first met with Dan and when we agreed to move forward with this, I looked him in the eye and I shook his hand and I told him that this was not going to be a political statement one way or the other. And the other promise that I made was that it was about Michael. All we had to do every day when we worked was just stay true to that. And it was easy. It was easy from there.
Have you gotten any responses from any of the other families of the personnel that were involved in the mission?
Oh, sure. We're all supportive of each other. Because, first and foremost, Michael was part of a team. It wasn't a Michael's effort. And in my remarks to that I give, I always say, as much as Michael fought and died for his men fought and died for him.
You've mentioned Lone Survivor a couple times, and since that comes out on a wide release this week.
To be perfectly honest, I think the movie better tracks the story that Gary lays out in Seal of Honor than I think Marcus originally did in Lone Survivor, because Gary in his methodical research brought out the substance of what happened on that mountain and how it happened, so that while Marcus was there and gave his story the way he understood it and unfolded, Gary's attempts afterwards to look at not just Marcus's work, but everything that was surrounding it, I think puts it in better context.
What do you want people to take away from this movie after seeing it?
I hope what they take away from the movie is that there are servicemen, first responders out there every day doing a job, a dangerous job, and they don't ask for any thank yous. They don't ask for anything. They just do their job helping others. And that it's not just about them. It's about the families that are behind them. Because for every first responder and armed service personnel who's out there on the front lines, there's a family behind him or her. Mike could be any serviceman, servicewoman, Navy SEAL, Delta operator, Special Forces, and the family that's behind them.
Scott?
I would echo Dan's sentiment. When a family loses a warrior the way that Dan and Maureen lost Michael, it's not this vacuum of sorrow in one house in Long Island. It's a whole community that feels that.
Well, thank you both for taking the time to talk to me. Scott, thank you for making the movie. Dan, thank you for your service to this country and your sacrifice and your son's service to this country.
Kevin, thank you for having me on, giving me the opportunity to talk about Michael and also about Scott's wonderful movie, Murph the Protector.
If you want to hear the full interview, because I had to edit it down quite a bit to fit in the time we had allotted, you can go to fatguysatthemovies.com and you can get the complete 20-minute interview where I talk with both Scott and Dan about the entire situation. It's a very inspiring story, and it really shows what good guys we have out there in the field. This is for Murph the Protector, which is available on DVD and Blu-ray as a Walmart exclusive, so you're going to have to go trek out to the store, probably order it online on Walmart.com if you want to get a copy. But I encourage you to do so, especially after you see Lone Survivor, to sort of see another side to the story that is equally as inspiring. But of course, since we're talking about DVDs, you hear that noise? It is time now for what we like to call the world-famous DVD Roundup. So yeah, we've got Murph the Protector. That is out there. Definitely worth checking out. There's also a bunch of other movies. There's a ton of movies out this week. You got stuff like Runner Runner, which nobody saw either in the theaters, at least in America. And they didn't send me a copy, which just shows that they don't have a whole lot of confidence in it. I kind of want to see it because it's got Ben Affleck and Justin Timberlake in a good nefarious dealings on the island. So I kind of wanted to see that movie. I'm kind of upset that they didn't send it to me, but I'll red box it when it becomes available. There's also Thanks for Sharing. We talked about this earlier in 2013. It's about sex addiction and the different stages of it. What I liked about it was it offered, a different take on it. It didn't exploit it as much as something like Shame did. Although it's a bit of a hard sell if you are going with a date. Say, hey, let's watch the sex addiction movie. That'll be fun. There's also Closed Circuit, which, again, not very many people saw. This one is a Focus Features. It's second half is a lot weaker than its beginning, but it has a really neat setup about these barristers in London who are trying to go, who are prosecuting a terror suspect, and sort of how they end up being watched, because of course London is the place where all the cameras are and they get to see people. The Act of Killing is an award-winning documentary about, it profiles, power in the Indonesian government, these figureheads who were responsible for just committing genocide to the Chinese descendants and communists in Indonesia back in the 50s and 60s. And it shows them fondly remembering it. It's a very disturbing movie to see. Sim, if you think that Wolf of Wall Street glorifies bad acts, you need to see this movie and how these people being interviewed glorify their own acts of killing. There's also The Wicker Man on Blu-ray, which is a cheesy, you know, film from the 70s. This is not the Nicolas Cage one. It's also not going to cause the rapture. And then Archer Season 4, which is a very funny series on FX about spies. The stinker of the week is Duck Dynasty Season 4, and it's nothing to do with politics. It's because it's reality TV. People, seriously, just dial back on the reality TV, because as a whole, I don't care whether it's Duck Dynasty or the Kardashians, it's a terrible thing that's happening to our culture. That about wraps it up. Thank you for listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. We are going to be talking next week about Jack Ryan, The Nut Job, Ride Along, and Devil's Due. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.